the next edition. And until then, stay safe and bye-bye. We are almost out of time for this episode, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends in this industry and its related trades. The wire and cable industry get most of its raw material from the mining sector, and copper productions have gone through the roof recently. Iran is self-sufficient in the production of copper cathode that is used to make wires. Based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade, domestic production of copper cathode rose by 9% last year. As reported, nearly 200,000 tons of cathode were produced in 2021. That's close to the government goal, which aims to increase cathode output to roughly 230,000 tons in the coming years. Copper and aluminum are frequently used in wires because of their low resistance and excellent conductivity. Plus, these materials are relatively resistant to corrosion, which allows for various types of applications. Home appliance manufacturing was up nearly 10% last year, despite several challenges and restrictions on the growth of this sector. The Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade says home appliance manufacturing stood at 15 million sets last year. This registered a 78% increase in production compared to the year before. Ministry officials say the home appliance industry's infrastructure and capacities have developed in leaps and bounds over the last 5 years. Owing to this, the country is projected to become a major exporter of such products in the coming years. The government has increased support for domestic production to neutralize the impacts of the U.S. sanctions and diversify the economy away from oil revenues. The home appliance sector has been one of the pioneers in this regard as it witnesses significant progress.
Dozens of electricity projects have been launched this year in Yazd province to bring areas in this region online with the power grid.
Nearly 130 projects worth $4 million started in Yazd province. The developments fall into four categories. These include network construction, electricity supply to rural areas, repairing networks, and improving lighting for cities and villages. Yazd Electricity Distribution Company estimates over 100,000 meters of low and medium voltage pressure cables need to be installed for these projects. According to the distributor, the province has some 73,000 electricity subscribers, but almost 75% of power is used by industries.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in and see you next time on another edition of Bazaar.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A misconstrued move by a college in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to ban girls, read Muslim, wearing hijab from attending classes has stirred up a controversy that is being politicized by anarchist elements who over the past few decades have created an atmosphere of Islamophobia by infiltrating the administrative and government apparatuses. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Kayhan International. This article is published under the heading Hijab, the Emblem of Feminine Freedom and Virtues. Here's the story. February 1st was observed as World Hijab Day. Not in Muslim societies, where most women wear modest clothes in public and cover their heads, but in the non-Muslim world, where of late women have begun to discover the beauty and the benefits of putting on a headscarf while out of the privacy of their homes, without bothering anyone and without getting bothered. This is neither a revolutionary approach nor a rigid act of religiosity. This is, in fact, a commendable choice by women in accordance with innate feminine nature to protect self-dignity and guard themselves from unnecessary looks, glances, and whistles of the human wolves prowling in public places to disturb the peace and order of societies. Moreover, the headscarf or the hijab, and whatever you like it to call, is the revival of cultural values of the Christian West, as well as of the Buddhist and Hinduist, where women throughout history have been known to put on veils and cover their heads in a fashionable manner before the industrialization of the machine age has unfortunately eroded these age-old norms. This has led to widespread social ills, especially the forced unveiling of women by unprincipled politicians who have intentionally or unintentionally turned their wives, sisters, daughters, and even mothers into commercial and carnal objects on the pretext of ill-defined freedom and liberties. In India, Hindu women have traditionally donned the gungat, a kind of head covering in public. And this widespread practice, even today in the rural parts, is greatly respected by the people. It is the choice of women and is definitely not a hindrance to any social role they intend to or ought to play while pursuing education at schools and colleges or at working in order to create and preserve a healthy atmosphere. In view of these undeniable facts, recently a misconstrued move by a college in the southern Indian state of Karnataka to ban girls, read Muslim, wearing hijab from attending classes has stirred up a controversy that is being politicized by anarchist elements who, over the past few decades, have created an atmosphere of Islamophobia by infiltrating the administrative and government apparatuses. It is not known whether the authorities of that particular college in UDP district allowed themselves to be duped by misconstrued measure in France against hijab at educational centers, or whether they were ordered by hate-mongering politicians to take such a blundering decision. The move threatens to spiral out of control and spread all over the country. India is a polyglot country with the largest number of Muslims in any land, numbering over 300 million and accounting for 25% of the national population, while the other 75% is made up of the Hindu majority and the tens of millions of Dalits, followed by such minorities as Christians, Sikhs, Jains, Zoroastrians, and several other religions. It is a nation famous for its unity in diversity and its spirit of brotherhood amongst the various religions, sects, cultures, languages, and customs. It owes its development and progress to the nonviolent spirit of its founding fathers, such as Mahatma Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, who, in alliance with their Muslim compatriots, won independence from British colonialism. Therefore, it is unfortunate for the petty politicians of today, who definitely will not be remembered by history except in negative terms, to destroy the fabric of national unity, either through their silence or by dragging of the issue of hijab at educational centers to the courts. The wisest move, in the interest of not just Karnataka state, but all of India, is to nip the controversy in the bud by cancelling the unwise decision of the college authorities and allowing hijab-clad girls to attend classes before anarchic elements succeed in their nefarious designs to tear apart the country.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the newsline.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centres. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mushaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdul Jalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems, but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution. Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al-Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community. Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al-Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the approval, the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz in Yemen. And it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right in the middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating lands from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army is vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks. As the Saudi war in Yemen rages on, clashes and cross-border strikes have escalated in the past few weeks. The Yemeni army has conducted several strikes on targets deep inside the United Arab Emirates in response to what it calls the Sheikhdom's complicity in the crimes committed against the people of Yemen. Sana'a has promised to continue the cross-border strikes until the blockade on Yemen is lifted and the war on the country is ended. But how is the UAE involved in the war? The country has been supporting the so-called Southern Transitional Council separatists in southern Yemen since at least 2018. Those are the mercenaries that took control of Yemen's resource-rich Socotra Island in 2020. This move was a departure from its coalition partner, Saudi Arabia, who is only interested in keeping the Yemeni army away from its border. But the UAE has shown interest in controlling the port of Aden as well. Its focus is to have control over the important waterway, the Bab al-Mandab, an important oil shipping route.
Clearly, that's exactly the intention and the reason that Israel is involved is partly because that also means that they have at least the tacit approval of the United States as well. So they think that the UAE thinks that this is the way that they will be able to control this sea route. They're also building a base on the island of Perim, or Mayum, as it's called, just off the coast of Taiz, in Yemen, and it's actually, this is also Yemeni territory. But it's right in the middle of the Bab al-Mandab. It's right middle of the routes of 20,000 ships that pass through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal.
The Yemeni army has in recent weeks been fighting and liberating land from the separatists in the provinces of Shabwa and Marib. The UAE is Saudi Arabia's main partner in the years-long war that Riyadh and its allies have been waging against Yemen to change the impoverished country's ruling structure. The military campaign has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turned the entire Yemen into the scene of what the United Nations calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The onslaught enjoys American military, logistical, and political support. The UAE is one of the most advanced air defense systems in the Persian Gulf region, but they haven't been quite successful at stopping the Yemeni army's missiles and drones. The Emiratis are now looking at South Korea, Israel, and France to supply them with additional weaponry and ammunition. In its largest arms export deal in history, South Korea agreed with the UAE to sell $3.5 billion worth of Cheongung II advanced medium-range surface-to-air missiles, along with accompanying radars. Abu Dhabi is also in talks with Tel Aviv to buy its missile system, dubbed the Iron Dome. The UAE is also eyeing purchasing either Israel's Barak 8 or Spider missile systems. The systems will be installed in addition to American-made THAAD air defense batteries. And all of this comes in the backdrop of the U.S. playing a more prominent role by sending an aircraft carrier and fighter jets to the UAE. In one recent attack by the Yemeni army, the U.S. shot down the Yemeni army missiles. What does all this signal? Will this mean that the Emirates is bent on pressing ahead with its aggression against Yemen, despite the obvious losses of its mercenaries on the ground in the war-ravaged country? And the U.S., along with Israel, have promised support.
The UAE had its own goals in Yemen, which were not the same as those of Saudi Arabia. But they could only happen. The UAE could only fulfill its goals in South Yemen if there was, the Saudi Arabia succeeded in its goals in northern Yemen. That is, Yemen had to be torn apart and split between Saudi Arabian influence and UAE influence.
At any rate, the Yemeni army has vowed to continue to pound targets deep inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE until the war is over. The Yemenis are warning that the Emirates and its trade-based economy won't be able to withstand the attacks.
Meet the latest addition to Iran's diverse missile arsenal, Khaybar Shekan, a state-of-the-art missile unveiled earlier this week. It can strike its targets within a range of 1,450 kilometers with pinpoint precision. The ballistic missile is solid-fueled and therefore will be ready for launch much faster than liquid-fueled projectiles. It's even much faster and lighter than other Iranian solid-fueled models and can carry a powerful warhead. Ballistic missiles fly up into outer space before returning to hit their targets with a somehow predictable trajectory. This makes them vulnerable to interception by air defense systems. But Iran's armed forces say Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for any advanced missile shield. Iran has been manufacturing various types of military equipment and weapons, including missiles, despite many rounds of Western sanctions against its arms industry and other sectors. Missiles are one of the cornerstones of Iran's defense doctrine. Iran has the Middle East's most diverse arsenal of projectiles. From very short-range rockets to advanced ballistic and cruise missiles with pinpoint capabilities, Iran has been working hard to enhance them, both in terms of range and precision.
Iran is merely trying to keep up in order to defend itself. I mean, I'm sure Iran and the Islamic Revolution would like to spend that money elsewhere. But as long as you're being threatened, it is necessary to develop yourself to a degree in order to be able to have that defense. Now, you can have all the greatness that you want, but if you're not capable of defending it, you'll eventually lose it.
The Iranian pursuit of more advanced projectiles has been relentless. It makes no secret of it, because Tehran says they are a must for effective defense in the world's most dangerous region. But how did Iran master the technology to produce advanced projectiles despite decades of sanctions and import bans imposed by the West? The Iranian missile program grew out of the war initiated by the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they had no choice but building their own defense industry domestically and independently. The latest Iranian achievements are a far cry from the earliest models. Meanwhile, the West, especially the United States and its close allies, have described Iran's missile arsenal as a threat. They have tried to push Iran to abandon it, but Iranians seem to have learned to listen from the past and insist that their defensive missile power is a red line that will never be negotiated.
There has been a great deal of growing hostility towards Iran from the imperialist powers, and that in doing so, they have forced Iran to develop greater and greater weapons with the capacity to defend themselves. They are under assault from imperialism, and this is a constant ongoing threat from the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia, who have formed the imperialist bloc inside of the Middle East.
When repeated Israeli threats against Iran are taken into account, the need for a robust defense program seems more urgent. Iran says its military might will enhance regional security. It also insists that it will never start a war, but if attacked, a crushing response will definitely follow.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our magnanimous Imam, rahmatullah alayhi, changed the direction with Iran, thus bringing about a profound transformation. He changed the path of the Iranian people. He changed the trajectory we were on, and he moved us towards lofty goals. These goals, which guided us with the help of the Imam of the Revolution, rahmatullah alayhi, and that guided the Iranian society towards the revolution, were extremely important. The sum of all these goals is the authority of God's religion. The authority of God's religion calls for social justice in the real sense of the word. It calls for uprooting poverty, ignorance, and oppression. It calls for preparing a collection of Islamic values. It calls for uprooting social detriments. It calls for providing physical, moral, and spiritual health and scientific progress for the country. It calls for offering national dignity, national and Iranian identity, and international power. It calls upon man to activate the capacities that God has given this land. All these terms are included in the authority of God's religion. It was Imam rahmatullah alayhi who moved us towards this path. This is the exact opposite of the path towards which we were being dragged during the time of Taghut, the Pahlavi era.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This is a special coverage of a live event.
Dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program to have the live coverage of the televised speech of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the occasion of the uprising of the people of Tabriz on February 18, 1978, that is 29th of Bahman in 1356, against the Pahlavi regime. Please stay tuned.
Brilliance of Tabriz in the history of the revolution. The 29th of Bahman is a source of pride and is a source of brilliance for the city of Tabriz in the course of the history of the revolution. Before referring to this occasion of 29th of Bahman, since the day marks 15th of Rajab, and it's the day of worshiping God and performing prayers, I deem it necessary to mention the fact that our youths must take steps in order to boost their spiritual strength. All of us are in need of this, but young people better absorb the elements of spirituality. Perhaps a person like me may also perform the prayers, but when this is done by a young person, it will be more beneficial. That's the property of being young. I recommend the youths to seize the opportunity of the month of Rajab, and today is the 15th of Rajab. They should seize this opportunity. Of course, it's been recommended to also observe 3 days of fasting. Of course, the prayers can be the relevant prayers can be conducted and performed without becoming fasters. But that will add to the blessings of this land. It will add to the blessings of the future of the revolution. Regarding the 29th of Bahman, firstly, this day for the city of Tabriz and for all of us, it's a day that we should all thank God. And that is the point I wish to focus upon. It's a day of thanking God. Why? Because this day, the event that was unfolded in Tabriz on this day led to the bearing of fruits of the revolution. This event contributed to the activities on the field that bore fruits. That's been the outcome of the event that took place on this day in the city of Tabriz. It was actually an innovative action. It was an important act. It was the continuation of the uprising on 19th of day in the city of Qom, and it showed its impacts to everyone. If that event did not take place in Tabriz on 29th of Bahman, the tradition of continuing the struggle would not actually couldn't take place. So on the 40th day of the martyrdom of the martyrs of Qom, that was that commemoration of the 40th day of the martyrdom was an initiative by the city of Tabriz. It acted as a role model in other cities such as Yazd, Kerman, and also in cities of Fars province and the other areas and regions. Such initiatives took place, and this movement brought the people into the field of struggle for the sake of the revolution, and that led to the triumph of the revolution. The triumph of the revolution was due to the people's presence on the scene, on the streets. It did not triumph by weapon through political factions or so on. It triumphed due to the people's presence. And these public movements started in Tabriz, so all of us, including you, the people of Tabriz, we should all thank God due to the blessings brought about by this initiative and led to the triumph of the revolution. The 29th of Bahman is an event that unfolded, and Azerbaijan has seen many events, has witnessed many events since several centuries ago. Since three or four centuries ago, Azerbaijan has been played a leading role with respect to national steadfastness. It's been a focal point for creating unity amongst the people. It's been the focal and important focal point for teaching resistance and steadfastness to the people in the face of various events. So this is a source of pride for this city and province. And it's a source of pride for the city and the province. One of the major privileges of this province is that the people of Azerbaijan have always carried the banner of respecting the Prophet's infallible household. This banner has been carried by the people of Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan has a special feature, and that's also a source of pride. Therefore, the 29th of Bahman movement led to the continuation of the struggle, and I want to say a few words about this topic. The continuation of a struggle is the key to its victory. If a movement starts and if it fails to continue, if it fails to take further steps, such a movement will be futile. It will lose its validity. We know movements and revolutions in the world, they started in a good way and it took major steps forward, but they failed to triumph. Why? Because the participants, the members of that movement, or the leaders of that movement, or the followers of that movement, the masses, they refused to continue the path. They either became tired or became disappointed, or they became entangled with materialistic issues, or they were disappointed, or they were intimidated, or they suffered from internal differences. In other words, they eventually failed to take further steps forward, and that led to the failure of their movement. So the continuation of the struggle is the key for the triumph and victory of every movement. So what took place on 29th of Bahman was the key point in the continuation of the struggle. The people of Tabriz contributed to the commencement of people's activities on the field. There were different types of movements and struggles in the past, but people's presence on the scene started in Qom, and what took place in, and if the event didn't take place in Tabriz, that would have caused the what happened in Qom to be forgotten. So that's been the starting point for the continuation of the massive movement that had started. This initiative strengthened the people, and they came to the scene, and actually it contributed to the leadership of the late Imam, and the late Imam issued two messages following the event that unfolded in Tabriz. And the path towards the revolution was clarified, and it became clear what the people should do in order to contribute to the triumph of the revolution. This was shown to the people by the event that was unfolded on 29th of Bahman. And in fact, the people came to know that they should not be fearful of the appearance of the Taghut. So, speaking of the Imam's logic, that's been an important point in his policies. After the triumph of the revolution and the formation of the Islamic establishment, The late Imam tried to continue the movement, and the Imam's enlightening remarks boosted the morale of the people and showed the right path to the people and reminded the people of their objectives, the objectives behind the movement, and that was a driving force. And in the initial steps after the triumph of the revolution, the Imam did not neglect this point. Even after he became sick and he, despite his ailment, he did not forget the need to continue this path, and this led to the foiling of the enemy's plots, and that contributed to the revitalization of the revolution. In late 1979, Tabriz faced an attack by the counter-revolutionary elements. This has been recorded, and all the people know this. And Tabriz faced a counter-revolutionary move in Tabriz. There were a limited number of such counter-revolutionary elements, and there were others coming from outside of the city. And there was some help given to them by certain elements, by some who wanted to disrupt the situation. Some were concerned. At that time, we raised the issue at the Revolution Council, and some were seriously concerned. Imam said that the people of Tabriz will settle this problem. This was Imam's logic. He mentioned this in his address, and he said that there is no need for any interference by others, and Tabriz will actually resolve this problem. Martyr Madani, after Martyr Qazi, he was the leader of the Friday prayers. Martyr Madani was present on the scene, and there were more young people joining him, thousands of young people alongside him managed to overcome this conspiracy. That was Imam's approach, his behavior, so that led to such a major success, and that was a step forward. That was the nature of Imam's performance and approach. To name another example of Imam's approach in this regard, I can refer to the arrangements made at the time of the during the years of the Holy Defense, from the very first day of the attack by Saddam. From that very first day till the last day of the war, 8 years of war, and the acceptance of the resolution, Imam gave new strength to the people, the officials, and boosted their morale. And in fact, speaking of the war imposed on the nation, the late Imam used that and turned it into a tool in order to boost the people's strength. And we were empty-handed at that time. We didn't have weapons and the needed facilities. We were not properly organized for countering the enemy. We had limited facilities, and it was in the early days of the revolution. There were so many problems. So we had a revolutionary nation without the needed facilities. The imam actually turned the war into a tool in order to add up to the nation's international credibility. The war was designed by the enemies in order to destroy the revolution. Imam turned the war into a tool for strengthening and reinforcing the revolution, and actually turned the threat into an opportunity. To give you more examples of Tabriz, I can tell you that the student at Tabriz University, I'd seen Martyr Bakiri prior to the revolution. I had a friend in Mashhad, Martyr Bakiri came to Mashhad. I saw Mahdi Bakiri. He was an ordinary student. An imam turned him into a prominent commander, a role model. That was done by the imam, Mehdi Bakiri and Qasim Soleimani, martyr Qasim Soleimani. They were created by the late imam. That was the movement for the continuation of the revolution. And such a movement turned the youths into the characters of the revolution, the pioneers of the revolution. So the issue of continuation of a revolutionary movement that I mentioned with respect to the event of 29th of Bahman that acted as a driving force for the continuation of the revolution, that's been one of the most important topics related to the history of our land today and tomorrow. We should follow this up and think about it, contemplate upon it. And we have all learned this from the late imam. Now, what is the meaning of continuing a revolutionary path? If you want to just give examples, I've already mentioned some, but generally speaking, what are the instances of such continuation of movement? It means that we should consider the objectives of the revolution and also consider all our requirements today and tomorrow. What are the requirements that will realize those objectives, and we should obtain these needs and requirements? This means the continuation of the revolution. To consider the goals pursued by the revolution, and there are some tools required in order to attain those goals. There are some requirements. Some are short-term and some are related to the present time. Some are related to the future. And we should make the preparations for tomorrow. So we should obtain these requirements. This means continuation of the revolutionary movement. And I will give you more examples. So what do we mean by the goals of the revolution? That means country's progress, social justice, the country's strength and power, formation of an Islamic society in the country. These are amongst the goals pursued by the revolution, and eventually attaining the modern Islamic and grand civilization. These are the goals pursued by the revolution. So, in order to attain and administer social justice, in order to attain national progress, not just hollow progress, I mean spiritual and material progress, in order to create an Islamic society where Islamic laws are fully implemented and the people benefit from the realization of these Islamic laws in order to reach the point of Islamic civilization. What are the requirements? So every person, based on his capabilities and capacities, must take steps for obtaining those requirements. Therefore, I'm going to give you some examples. Efforts by scientists and researchers. Efforts made by a scientist or a researcher. This is a move for the continuation of the revolution.